It's Lucy Litch, and this is Tiny House Conversations. It's the Australian-based podcast where I interview experienced tiny houses, tiny builders, and adventurers in the tiny world so you can discover how to create, build, and transition into tiny life. Welcome back to another episode of Tiny House Conversations. On the show today, I'm speaking with Paul Dolphin, who is a sustainable building designer and director of PDD Building Design, who are a dedicated team of building designers specializing in creating livable, low-energy homes and are based on the beautiful New South Wales South Coast. I actually know Paul through yoga and chanting, and so it was really great to get to know more about this side of him, as he's very passionate, as you'll get to hear in this episode, about all things sustainable building design. And in this conversation, we talk about the three pillars to consider when assessing sustainability, all about embodied energy, thermal mass, insulation, ventilation, and solar passive design. We also talked about designing a tiny home with hazards and bushfire principles in mind, Paul's experience of dealing with councils for dwelling approval, and Paul even shares a funny analogy that he feels describes the situation with council, especially with many, many years of navigating things with them and just seeing what's happening behind the scenes. So make sure you stay tuned for that, because that's towards the end of the show. So let's get to the podcast and onto this tiny house conversation with Paul. Hey, Paul, welcome to Tiny House Conversations. It's so good to have you on the show today.
And thanks for having us.
So, Paul, you have a background in sustainable building design, and I know that you've had a journey of getting there, and we're going to, you know, talk a lot more about that, especially as they're related to tiny houses. But first, I just love if you're able to start by just giving us a bit of your background. How did you get into doing what you do today around sustainable building design?
Well, that's going to take up the whole.
The overview.
I've always been fascinated by architecture my whole life, buildings, public spaces, parks, everything like that. And when I was at school, in my last year of school, I unfortunately got really sick and ended up with fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, which meant that I left school with no qualifications whatsoever, as opposed to like the year before, I was predicted to leave with all good grades and that. So I ended up spending a few years not very well at home. And then eventually got myself better by going out and becoming a gardener. And I got back into university through doing landscape architecture. But all the time, I always had this pull, whatever I've done, I've always had this pull back towards buildings itself. So even when I was doing landscape design, I was always pestering my lecturers to let me go and focus on buildings, or, you know, focus on historic buildings, that sort of stuff. And then gradually over time, I've been pulled towards buildings, and I went and became a building surveyor for a time, and then eventually moved over to Australia and became a building designer. And actually, that route, although circuitous, has actually given me such a breadth of information and experience that allows me to, I think, really apply all that information in the minuscule area of building design. You know, so I can pull in landscape design, I can pull in building surveying, and all the defects and all the impact of different forms of design, and apply them to my work. With regards to sustainable design, I became very interested in sustainable design probably about 25 years ago. And every piece of work I did at university and everything I've been trying to do has been focusing towards sustainable design through the years. Yeah.
So good. And were you also a town planner at some point too, or you were involved in something like that?
Yeah, my first degree was landscape architecture and town planning.
So you can see that.
So we do town planning as what – Part of our business is town planning as well. So kind of like every layer of design, we've kind of got a little bit of background on.
Yeah, I can see how like all the pieces can fit together very relevantly, and you can call upon a wide range of experience and knowledge and the training that you've had too. And I'm just curious for you, so when we're talking about sustainability, I know in the tiny house industry, and I understand it is in, you know, the regular building industry, but it's also in many other sectors as well. This it seems to be like a, what do you call it? I don't know. It's like a bit of a buzzword, right? And there can be some greenwashing going on in many different industries, including the tiny house industry. And so I'm wondering from your experience and your own perspective and just all that you've, you know, come across over the years, what would you say from your perspective is sustainability? How would you define that? How would you even approach navigating that? And I know it's probably a loaded question, but anything that you can share on that?
It's a really good question, and it's something that I do bring up with my clients, because you're right, everybody has a different perception of what sustainability means.
Yeah.
And for myself, whenever I do any talks about this or anything like that, we always go back to the Brundtland definition, of which was the original definition of sustainability, which is development for the present, which doesn't hinder development of future generations, is paraphrasing of it. But essentially, sustainable design encompasses three aspects. It's economic sustainability, social sustainability, and environmental sustainability. So when I have clients who come to me, you know, I use the example of a mud brick house. Now, a mud brick house is great in terms of environmental sustainability. If you're going to build a mud brick house with mud from your land, you know, that is about as low carbon as you can get it. You know, nothing's being transported, all that sort of stuff. However, if you're going to pay someone to do that, that's going to be the most expensive build because it's the most labor intensive. So economically, it's not that sustainable because you've got to pay a tradie at whatever price. Or alternatively, you do it yourself every weekend. And then it turns into a Grand Designs episode where, you know, 10 years later, they've still got no roof on because, you know, it's socially unsustainable because you've got to do it every weekend for decades. So that's a good example of, you know, the balance of sustainability. Yes, it's environmentally sustainable, but potentially not economically or socially sustainable. And so it's really a balance of those three things. And then as designers, and again talking about our broad experience, we are here to help people navigate that, so, you know, to get what people perceive as a sustainable design. And that comes back to, again, my background, which was when I was at first at university, I thought we should have deep eco, which should be mud brick and straw bale, and, you know, get rid of all toxic chemicals and everything that we've ever done, throw it all out, start again. And then I became a building surveyor and I surveyed 5,000 houses. And I realized that oftentimes when we have defects in buildings is where we are using new materials in a way that's not been fully thought through. So, you know, if we use straw bale and we've not thought about how it's going to sit against a non-breathable wall wrap, then we could end up with mildew, damp and mold growth, you know, these sorts of things. And so I swung back to what I call the middle way. And I realized if we can use as much off-the-shelf product as we can and use that in a sustainable manner. So really not worrying too much about the materials we use, but worrying how we use those materials to create shade in summer and free heat in winter, basically. Yeah. And also, you know, to talk to the tiny home point, also not being wasteful with our design. You know, so not being unnecessarily decorative, not being unnecessarily wasteful in the number of rooms we have, and not using decoration for decoration's sake, trying to keep the design functional and sustainable, really.
There's so many great things that you said in there that I'd love to just like pull these little bits and pieces out. It's like the trifecta almost. You're talking about those three areas that you sort of have to try and keep in balance and consider, and then also one thing that I find super interesting. I love that you brought up the example about the straw bale home, and like you're saying, okay, that's a really natural type of material we can use. But then if we're not actually using it in a way that is going to then potentially create another problem, like what you're saying, like with excess moisture and mold, which is then also a health hazard, which is then not sustainable. That's something to consider too. And I'm also curious about what you said around using off-shelf products and not worrying as much about the full-on non-toxic stuff and sort of using the most sustainable practices that you can. Because one of the things that I talk a lot about on this podcast, and it's also important for myself and what I went through when I was designing my own tiny home, was and it's because I've been very down the path of health for a really long time, is actually one of my number one values was I needed to make sure as much as possible, of course it's not 100% and not perfect, but to have as low tox as possible. So using like different natural materials where possible, like natural paints and finishes, also constructing the home from a viewpoint of electromagnetic radiation too, so not having electrical wiring and wireless things around the bedroom and appliances, and sort of seeing the building of my own tiny home and the sustainability of that, and for me as a human living in my tiny home for as long as possible and not having health impacts that come from the way the home is constructed or what's actually what it's constructed by. So I'm curious about how that may or may not fit into what you do as a sustainable designer, because you did say the mud brick and the straw bale, but you've moved away a little bit from it. So how does that fit into what you do now, like the non-toxin?
So that was probably a slight slip of the tongue there.
Yeah.
What I fully agree with what you're saying about low VOC construction, zero formaldehyde construction. Yes, our livable spaces should definitely have as little off-gassing and as little pollutants in there as possible.
Yeah,
totally agree with that. But we don't need to throw everything out that we've got. What we need to do is we need to be pestering the manufacturers for those low VOC products. We need to be spending our money on the low VOC products, choosing wisely where we can, but where we can't, not sweating the small stuff, really. Let me try and give you an example. So concrete is a great example. Obviously, tiny home, you're not going to have much concrete in there, but normal house, we would advocate for a slab on ground where we can, because of the benefits of the energy savings over the lifetime of the building. So a standard building, if you look at the energy it's going to take to build and run that building, only 20% of the building's energy is in its construction. The other 80% is in its running costs. So if we think about it like that, we can actually use super carbon intensive concrete and steel, if we can get it to be zero carbon for its lifetime. If we can get the building running for no energy whatsoever, then we can use this. We can use a product which is not sustainable in the broader terms. But then what we can, and so we've actually saved 80% of the building's running cost. So it's actually the most bang for our buck, even though, so if we went down the route of, again, and if we went down the route of using straw bale or trying to find some other product, we may find that we design in we design in defects, which means that the life of those products, that has to be replaced quicker. The other thing is that if we talk about concrete or steel, even though they're carbon intensive to begin with, they're actually quite inert when we look at off-gassing, and they can also be recycled as opposed to downcycled or landfilled. So with our kitchen in our house, we've got a stainless steel, off-the-shelf commercial kitchen. Now, that's that was carbon intensive to produce, but at the end of its life cycle, let's say we sell our house and someone doesn't like it, well, that can be given to the local, you know, to a local campsite or a charity that then will use it for another 30, 40 years.
Yeah.
Or it can be recycled. It can be melted down and made into something else. Mm. Whereas a lot of, a standard kitchen in a new home, not only is it often, it's a little bit like a coffee pod. You know, you're actually blending plastic, metal, wood, glue all together. And not only that, but a lot of timber that we use in Australia is actually, or glue laminated products, they're actually banned in the rest of the world, you know. Yeah. So it's finding those off-the-shelf products that do have those low VOC products and that can be, you know, recycled or used in a sustainable way.
Yeah. And I love how you said, so it's almost like this demand will then influence the supply. So the more that you're asking for manufacturers to use these types of things, or even just simply asking, do you have this available? If they get enough people to continually ask and ask and ask and want this, it's the same thing with tiny house builders. I'm finding it's a big education process at the moment of bringing in this aspect of building biology into the tiny house space, of considering all these types of things beyond just being a small footprint home. Like, there's so much else that goes into it, obviously, like what you're talking about and a lot of other things. So I definitely feel like, yeah, we do need to just keep asking for these things and also educating people about them. And there's a few terms that you mentioned there when you were speaking before. So I think it'd be great to just, especially if someone's not fully aware or they've heard, you know, certain terms before, but they're not 100% sure about what they actually mean. So I think you talked about the energy of a space, or maybe in terms of like embodied energy. I know there's also, carbon footprints and even thermal mass and things like that. So are you able to just let us know just a brief understanding of these types of things?
Yeah. So embodied energy is the amount of energy that it makes, so that it takes to make a product.
Yeah.
So things like steel and concrete, we actually went up to the steelworks in Port Kembla to see how much energy goes into making the steel for just one spoon or one, it's incredible. And so that's the embodied energy, which is in this product, which is, but then we can, so there are products that have a lower embodied energy. But again, there's another term, which is cradle to cradle construction. So, aluminium is a good example. I think something like 70 or 80% of all aluminium that's ever been made is still in use today because it just gets recycled so much. So when we think about products, steel takes a lot of carbon to be manufactured, but then it can, if it's used properly at the end of the life of a building, it can be used again and again and again. Whereas some things can only be landfilled. So, there's a product, a lot of this cladding that goes on the outside of big high rises, which is now problematic, but that was actually, it's aluminium with plastic, with another layer of aluminium with plastic on. And again, it's like the coffee pod. The coffee pod is a terrible invention because it's plastic, aluminium, and coffee granules, all of which independently are infinitely recyclable.
Yeah.
Put them together and they have to be downcycled or thrown away. And that's a really important message, is not just the embodied energy of a product, but actually, can it be recycled in the future? Is it downcycled? You know, and then thermal mass is a really, really important tool when we talk about designing buildings. Thermal mass is a little bit, basically, it's like a pizza stone. If you think about putting a pizza stone or a hot water bottle, you fill a hot water bottle up and that retains the heat for many hours. And so does a pizza stone. And it's a way of balancing the temperature within a building. So if you think about a concrete block or a stone, like a sponge, basically, if a sponge will absorb water until it can't absorb any more water, and then it will start releasing the water. An item with a large thermal mass will absorb heat until it's full of heat, and then it will start radiating the heat. Or as the temperature drops, it will start to radiate heat. Mm. So if we have thermal mass on the inside of our building, and we can get the sun hitting that during the day in winter, then come the evening time when the temperature drops, this stone, concrete, slate, whatever it is, will start, mud brick or round earth, will start to release that heat back out. And it basically takes the peaks and troughs of heat and cool out of a building, and it makes a building more temperate.
Yeah. Okay, that's a really good analogy, actually. I'm imagining the pizza stone. You did mention also cladding there, and I'm just curious. So from your perspective on sustainable building design, so in tiny houses, often what happens with cladding is, and you would have seen this, and I know you've done some design with tiny houses too, but often what we see is color bond and then some kind of timber feature, or those are the two sort of most common things that we see. So from just the sustainability perspective and that trifecta that we talked about, what do you feel is like, what do you feel about using color bond, and what do you feel about using timber as cladding, for example, or are there other materials that you feel like might even be good to bring into the conversation around sustainability?
So if we're talking primarily, so the main way to save your energy through when you live in a building is by keeping it cool in summer and warm in winter. The main way that we would do that in our work is firstly through shading and orientation. I suppose the great thing about a tiny home is that you can kind of rotate it or move it, or, yeah, you know, like, yeah, if you don't get it right first time,
yeah,
you know, you can, and that's, I often say, you know, like, we're designing a house to do two things. It's got to be a bikini and a anorak as well, yeah, you know, like, yeah, it's quite hard.
Yeah.
You know, but mainly the first thing is shading, you know, and even stand in a park in summer and then go and stand, you know, stand in the sun and then go stand under a tree. Mm-hmm. And you really just see that shade, like, that's your big ticket item. Managing the sun, managing that sun coming into the building, that's the big ticket. But then the next analogy is thinking about an esky. You know, like, if we talk about that pizza stone for a minute, but let's flip it round to it being an ice block. Well, we want the ice block on the inside of the esky, and that inside of the esky is your living environment. Okay, you want to keep it cool, or you want to keep it warm. The outside of the esky is actually not relevant. It's actually what's on the inside is what's relevant, and it's what's between the you know, the wall of the esky is actually your air gap, which is your insulation. So you really want to have your shade and then your insulation. What actually goes on the outside of the building is not actually that relevant in terms of managing the internal space.
Mm.
It's actually it's how you manage the heat coming in, and that comes down to shading, windows, and insulation.
Mm.
But with regards to cladding, you're on the money with color bond, you're on the money with timber, you're on the money with WeatherTex. when we talk about that thermal mass, the one place we don't want it is we don't want it on the outside of the building, because it actually works against us then. So if we have thermal mass on the outside in summer, then that's going to get really, 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 really hot. And then at night, it's going to be like wearing a big hot jacket, and we can't get our heat out of the building. If you've ever spent a summer in London, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. Thermal mass everywhere. You cannot cool the buildings down. Yeah. Double brick. It's awful.
Yeah.
So when we talk about thermal mass, we actually want thermal mass like our ice block sitting on the inside of our insulation. So yeah, we want lightweight cladding on the outside of the building, particularly as a tiny home. It should always be lightweight cladding.
Yeah, yeah. Because, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because my experience, so I've been down here on the South Coast where you are also too, as you know. I've been here for a couple of years now in my tiny home, and I've got Colorbond around most of the home, and then just one end where I sleep is timber on the outside. And I don't have an actual, like, I don't have air conditioners, I don't have a heater or anything. I've found, though, that it hasn't been, like, where I'm living, it hasn't gotten ridiculously, ridiculously cold, like, to the point where I needed to have some kind of heater. Or maybe I've just turned my oven on, because it's such a small space, it actually doesn't take that long to heat up the space using an oven, right? And then I didn't need to have this extra thing. But in summer, what I found is on these really hot days, especially like what we're getting now, you know, we're going up into like the 34s, and it's even been like 37, 38 out here. I've found it really hard to cool down the space at night. And it is lucky that here where I'm parked, which is a little bit more inland than the coast, that the temperature drops quite a lot overnight. And even though I have all my windows and things open, it's still really, really hot. And I've often wondered, is it because I've got that Colorbond on the outside? Because also where my tiny house is situated on the land, it pretty much gets sun all day, but just obviously in different directions. So like behind me is where it rises, and then in front of the front door is where it sets, and so like it's all under the sun all day. So I often thought it was maybe the Colorbond or something, like, you know, having this little
Colorbond will benefit you in the summer.
Okay.
Because if you think about it like this, right, think about the pizza stone.
Yeah,
the pizza stone will retain heat. Or, you know, like an oven dish will retain heat for ages. But your baking tray, which is metal, you can pull that out of the oven. 10 seconds later, you can pick it up with your hand, right? So metal has very low thermal mass. Mm. Metal transports heat very, very quickly. So actually, your Colorbond will cool down really quickly. So it's not actually your Colorbond, which is causing you the problem.
I'm starting to realize. Yeah.
Is the climate as it's behaving in the last 3 years.
Yeah.
So, and again, the climate is behaving much more like an English climate, where we're not having our big diurnal swings. So by that, I mean, when I first moved here 11 years ago and up until 2020, we were generally, you know, there would be very few humid summer days. What you would get is, you know, you might get up to 40 degrees, but then 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the ocean breeze comes in and the evening would drop down to 15 degrees, 18 degrees, or even less. And what that does is that clear, cool sky is then sucking all the heat up. And so that will suck your heat up out of the building. The cool will come back in. And again, with our house, which is a solar passive designed house, we have windows which open low. So what happens is that cool night air, the heat is going to travel up towards the upper atmosphere, and that's going to pull cold air in, which will chill our slab back down so that we can be nice and cool again come the next day. The last 3 years, it's been humid, and we're getting rain at night and clouds, and everybody can't cool their buildings down,
Yeah.
because we don't, it doesn't, that model doesn't work.
Yeah.
So, we lived for 3 years in our house without an air conditioner. We've been using our air conditioner at night, because you can't, you just can't, you can't beat the physics of the
Yeah.
climate as it stands at
Yeah.
the moment.
Yeah, definitely. And I do know that it is different than what it was many years ago. Just what's happening at, in the environment at the moment. But yeah, for some reason I've always thought, well, it must be like the color bond just must be what it is. But yeah, learned something new.
So
So thank you for that. Yeah. Yeah.
it's the thermal mass of the
Yeah.
building. It's
Yeah.
so,
That
we
makes
talk
sense.
about concrete or mud as being the best ones, dense things, but everything has a thermal mass. So
Yeah.
basically your building is charging up. So the best way to balance that is actually to increase your external shading. So if you increase your external shading so that that building is staying cool for longer
Yep.
periods,
Yep.
then it will hopefully, the inside of the building should be able to stay as cool as possible for as long as possible.
Yeah.
Another thing that we did in our house is, the whirly birds, you can actually get those that are linked to your ceiling. So we actually, so you've got two types of passive ventilation. You've got cross ventilation and you've got stack ventilation. So where we built, we didn't know if we would get cross ventilation all the time. So I put these whirly birds into the roof, which are actually linked down into our ceiling. So we can open those and they are a bit of stack ventilation. And I think they would be really good for everyone building
Yeah.
a tiny home, is
Yep.
because then you can get that natural heat rising effect is going to be occurring even when you're not getting cross ventilation. So
Yeah. Okay.
I would strongly recommend those as a
Yeah.
design feature.
Okay. Maybe we'll put a link in the show notes. I'll get the details off you later for exactly what you're talking about, and we can put it in for anyone that's looking for that. Because yeah, in my loft bedroom, my tiny house, I've got like a window on both sides of my bed, so I do have that cross ventilation. And then right above my bed, I've got a skylight, so I can o wind it up and open it up, which helps a lot. But when it's been those really hot days, it has been that it's still been it's helped, but it's still been super hot. So maybe I have to look into the thing that you're talking about too. So thank you for sharing that. That's great. And you did mention there as well solar passive design. So I'd love if you're able to just share a little bit about what that is, just in case anyone hasn't heard about it before, or just doesn't know exactly what you mean by that.
So yeah, that's essentially making use of our winter sun to charge your building or your living space up, and then trying to exclude that sun in summer. So, essentially our northern sun is going to come in low in winter and high in summer. So if we have a north-facing elevation, it's quite easy to manage with our eaves. In winter, our sun is low and it's going to come into the building and heat the building up. In summer, it's going to sit high and it's going to be blocked by our eaves and it's not going to get into the living space. East and west becomes more problematic because the sun comes in, the sun rises and it's very low in the east, and that can come a long way into the building, which we don't want in summer. And we don't want it, the afternoon sun coming in summer. But then in winter, that east and west sun can be amazing for heating the building. And so that's where we play around with orientation of the building and fenestration, glazing management, and then shading. And again, we try to work on a lot of external shading that's going to stop the sun coming into the building in the first place. External shading is a lot better than blinds or curtains or even the types of glazing. And then what's the word? Mechanical or operational shading. So shading where we can exclude that summer sun, but then we can include it in winter. So shade sails or deciduous planting or shutters that we can move, that sort of stuff. So I actually talk about it a little bit more as actually solar active, like our house, we have shade sails, and I've got these old reclaimed Victorian shutters that we put up in summer, and then in winter we take them down, and we've got that winter sun coming in. And when we first moved into the house, we had a builder come round, and all night, whatever we were talking about, he would just stop and say, "Are you sure you've got no heating? Are you sure?" And he could not fathom, and a lot of builders do come into our house, and they cannot fathom that in the depths of winter, it might be 0 outside, and our house is 22 degrees, and they can't understand how we're doing it without heating, and it's just managing that sun,
That's
And
a good point.
that's not to say we don't use heating, because I should say, we are kind of like 80-20 in our design. Like, we can get you 80% of the way to solar passive. To get you 100% of the way, with sort of passive house design, I think that actually it becomes too expensive. And again, we go back to our little Venn diagram of sustainability. To get 100% solar passive, no active heating, no active cooling, it becomes an exercise in extreme construction methods, and it's not necessarily benefiting you or the environment. So it's about that balance. So we will often say, let's, for 80% of the year, we don't have heating or cooling, but we do have a wood-fired heater and we do have air conditioning, and we will, for example, the type of climate we're in at the moment, where it's very humid, we will have a hot sunny day and we'll have the aircon running, a dehumidifier, which is just cooling the space down, but that's running off our solar panels, which is, carbon neutral. But it's managing that space. To have got to have, I don't even know if, even in this climate at the present time, I think you would really, really, really struggle to get to a fully solar passive space,
100%.
just because of the nature of the climate as it stands.
Are you finding that maybe what worked or the different methods and practices that have been used for a really long time are sort of navigate things in a different way because of the drastic changes in climate now? Like that things are pretty unpredictable these days, right? Whether it, because I feel like we had a really sunny winter last year and now we're having a really sporadic summer with rain and humidity and, 20 degrees and then 34 degrees. Just taking a quick break from the conversation to let you know, I'm now offering tiny house consulting. I get questions all the time about tiny house living and have lots to share from my own personal experiences of going through the design process of building a tiny, finding the right builder for me, living in a tiny home, as well as through speaking with guests on the show and beyond. So if you have questions about your specific situation and you want to dive deeper into where to start, preparing to transition into tiny living, how to find a parking space for your home, or talking through what some of the best options could be for you when it comes to creating your dream tiny life, just know that I'm here for you. You can head over to tinyhouseconversations.com/consult. I'd love to help you on your tiny journey. Now, back to the show.
The last 3-4 summers since the fires have been harder to manage.
Yeah.
Because we're not getting that natural stack ventilation of an evening.
Yes. Yes.
But again, that's because we've had 3 El Ninos or 3 whatevers in a row. We don't know whether that's the new normal or whether that's just another cycle. I think it probably is just another cycle. I think we will go into another drought period. And again, that's the thing. We've got these kind of macro cycles which occur in Australia. So again, we're kind of trying to design for so much. And again, it's where I come back to this idea of an active house. You've got to be, it's got to sort of be an active space. And again, some of the things that I suppose that one of the things we have to navigate is being anchored to old fashioned thoughts about things. So, I've been on a, I went back to uni last year and did another sustainable design postgrad certificate. And I think it's really important for us to keep reappraising our information and knowledge. And, a good example is aircon. Aircon was the devil, in sustainable terms for so many years. However, if you have a solar system, and you're creating PV, or if you're living off grid, then aircon is not the devil. If it's only the devil if it's using fossil fuels. If it's not using fossil fuels, then it's a great option. And again, if, for example, you have a house that's south facing, all your views are south facing, or you've got an existing building, or you've got a site where you can't get thermal mass, sorry, you can't get solar into the building. Well, if we can get it in via a PV array, and then it's converted into air conditioning, it's having the same effect. It's just not directly sun glazing slab. It's sun, solar panels, heat pump. So that's a good example of where we've got to change our thinking about some of these things,
It's like it's evolving with the times, isn't it? And with nature and the cycles of nature, which we know this is what happens, So I'm curious as well. So are you able to let us know a little bit about the tiny house projects that you've been involved in when it comes to this sustainable building design?
I'd say there's a lot of people very interested in tiny home construction. We've done a few in Braidwood and Braidwood surrounds. They're often a jumping point for people. So people are going to go and live in their tiny home, and then do other works on their land, so maybe build a home later, or see how they exist in the tiny home and then see what else they need. I think one thing, I was going to talk about hazards, and the work I did in England with the hazard awareness surveying that I did. And I think that's really, really important in the design of tiny homes. And you've touched on it already with VOCs, volatile organic compounds, and off-gassing and that sort of stuff. Your tiny home is essentially all your rooms in your house in one space. So, for example, if we talk about if someone's just gone and bought a Bunnings kitchen, not to slag Bunnings off, but Bunnings potentially hasn't got a very high rating for certain carcinogens like formaldehyde or certain VOCs. So if you put that in your kitchen in a normal house, you're not spending every day in there. But if that's essentially next to your bed, then you could be compounding some of your risks. So I think what you were saying about a holistic design, a bio design, being really quite rigid in your approach to the choice of materials, I think is very important when you've condensed your living space down,
Because you're also closer to everything as well. It's everyone's different. Everyone has different values and, approaches the design of their tiny home differently. But you touched on hazards there, but I'm also curious about, so we did an episode all on bushfire resilience and tiny homes. I'll put a link in the show notes for anyone that hasn't heard that. It's episode 19. But just from your experience, because I know everyone has different experience, different perspectives, and different ways as well. So in terms of designing a tiny home to be With bushfire resilience in mind, what are some of the principles or some of the factors that you feel would be important to consider if someone was coming to you wanting to design in with that in mind?
Well, I guess there's two. When you say resilience, that's a really important word, because our experience in the fires was our house survived the fire by a couple of meters.
Wow.
But then, which was great, you know, and I put that down to the landscaping that we did around the house and the design of, you know, so yes, you've got to try and design your space that's going to survive the fire. But you've got to also remember that there were months and months and months leading up to the fire where we were breathing in, you know, unhealthy air every day. And then there's after the fire, you know, where we had intermittent power for 6 weeks. So that's really where resilience comes in. We have a solar system and a battery, and the battery has an EPS, which is an emergency power supply, which incredibly is not standard. So you actually have to ask for that when you have a battery put in. You know, backup power is fantastic because then you can run your fridge and you can survive. You can be resilient. You can run your water pump. I think one of the key things is, air quality. Feeding yourself, keeping yourself cool, you know, I think that's resilience.
Yeah.
I think with regards your house surviving a bushfire, I think that is case by case basis.
Yeah.
I think that not every location your house is necessarily going to survive. You know, it depends where you are. Like it's sometimes, and that's about how everyone having a personal plan. You have to have a plan, you know, for bushfire survival. But the experience is once that front's gone through, you know, how are you going to live in that space until the world goes back to normal?
You know?
And I think that's resilience really. So it's your food, your air, your energy, really.
Yeah. And I love that you brought in the aspect about outside of the home, because it is something that we did talk about before on the other episode. Is it, you know, you can build your home, construct your home from materials that are going to be maybe better options to you to construct with in a situation like a bushfire. But of course, it's also what's happening on the outside too. Like if you've got, you know, if you're surrounded by things on the land that could easily, you know, you get some ember in there and goes alight. Like that's stuff that we've got to consider for sure. And I think if I remember correctly, it was a while ago, but there were different things that was it Tom Cooper was a tiny house builder who like specialized in this, but he was talking about just some of like the different building materials, not to use things like gas. He actually favored, you know, like solar and electrics versus having gas as, you know, a power supply and all sorts of little things there. So I think there's like lots of little things you can do, but at the same time, as you kind of alluded to, a bushfire can be so unpredictable, and it's going to, you know, for some people, it especially how prepared you are or where you actually are located, you know, the result or what happens is, you can't always be prepared.
We do work every day with all the different bow ratings, you know, from nothing up to flame zone.
Yeah.
And you have to remember that, I think the, you know, so our, you know, our bushfire hazard rating from, you know, from low to catastrophic or extreme, that was based on the Canberra fires. And that was like 0 to 100% basically. So catastrophic would be 100, you know, 100 out of 100. And I think the fires that came through in 2019 were something like 360 or 400 out of 100. In terms of their intensity. So, you know, when we're talking about fires like that, really, we, you know, you kind of, it's anybody's guess whether your house is going to survive. You know, it's really about you surviving and planning for those periods of time before and after. You know, it's not something that we can necessarily, there's a lot of factors outside of our control there.
Absolutely.
But going back to was it Tom's point about using gas? I think that's a really important point with tiny home design and going back to, your living space is being healthy. I suppose we've talked about volatile organic compounds and off-gassing. So a really important thing is to try and get as many products in your building that are zero formaldehyde. You know, zero formaldehyde and low VOC is a really good start. But there's two other things that should be identified, I suppose, is CO2 and CO, which is carbon monoxide. CO2 is what we create when we're talking and breathing. And there's been a lot of studies about, kids in schools where they're all starting to nod off is because all the windows are shut and there's not enough oxygen in there. So, a really important study would be, you can get, and I've got one I can lend it to you, is an air quality monitor. It's important to, this time of year, you're probably sleeping with the windows open all the time. But in winter, if you're sleeping with the windows closed, are you sleeping in a space which is actually creating too much CO2 and you're actually affecting your own sleep quality and that sort of stuff? That's an interesting one because we come up against, making our building so tight that we keep our warmth in versus air exchanges, which are going to keep us healthy, and that's something that we have to manage in sustainable design. The other one is CO, which is carbon monoxide, which is created by burning any product. So, I would never, never, never have a unflued gas appliance in your tiny home. I would never have one in a house. I was gobsmacked when I moved to Australia and walked into my brother's new house and I said, "What's that on the wall?" And he said, "Oh, it's a gas bayonet." And I looked up and I said, "Where's the flue?" And he goes, "You don't need a flue." I said, "What? You can just burn gas." And that's, you can still do that today. People are, put gas points in. And having come from the UK where they are all over carbon monoxide poisoning, and haven't actually experienced carbon monoxide. My partner Emma, we moved into a house and the boiler was an old-fashioned boiler, and she ended up in hospital with carbon monoxide poisoning. I still cannot believe that today in Australia we have unflued gas appliances, and so I would strongly recommend you don't do that. I would strongly recommend you don't have a gas hob, Interestingly, though, it becomes more challenging when we talk about our hot water, because I see a lot of tiny homes where you do have your gas hot water heating because it's a really efficient method of instantaneous heating. But again, I would say, well, look at the positioning of where that is next to a window. You don't have to have very much distance in terms of where that heater is versus where your windows are, and you can quite easily get, if you've got that window open, your gas heater's running, the wind's blowing, you're going to be getting carbon monoxide coming back into your space. So that would be something I would be very aware of in terms of the design of tiny homes.
I'm really glad that you said that because that is one of the most common things that you see in, I would say, most tiny houses, especially if they're constructed by a tiny house building company. Because even my own tiny home, because of what you mentioned, the efficiency of gas and hot water, that's the only thing that I have gas. I do have a solar trailer too, which powers everything else. And I was considering how could I maybe not do the gas? And but it was, I think when I was going through the process, it was just like I wasn't sure where I was going to be parked, and would I shoot myself in the foot if maybe I park somewhere and I didn't have enough sunlight all day and just all that kind of stuff. And so it was just easier to go with gas for now, but it is something that was on my mind for sure. And I didn't even consider the whole, you said, having an open window right near where that is. That's actually a really good point. I mean, mine is kind of around the corner from my bathroom and where the window is, but It is something that I think it's good to sort of let more tiny house builders know about this, because it does seem to be just that simple option, just because it is a more efficient, just a quicker way to, you know, heat the hot water or whatever it might be. But I was adamant that I didn't want to have an open flame inside my tiny home, because a lot of people also, that's the other thing that you see in a lot of tiny houses, not all of them, but they have the gas cooktop as well. Whereas I said, no, I want electric. So that's what I've done. But yeah, it's a tricky one to navigate, but I think it's very, very important.
It's a really difficult one. So yeah. I'm in my office now, which doubles as a granny flat, and we wanted to really try and come up with a good sustainable option for our hot water. And it's very difficult. It's so in our house, we've got a heat pump, which is the best way to heat hot water. Heat pump, with solar panels on the roof, it's the best way. So sand and heat pump, solar panels, it's great. Sometimes you're getting up to 600% efficiency. It's a really great way, but you don't really want to give such a large area. You know, it's a big tank. You know, that's going to take up, you know, probably one by one or something like it's a decent sized space. And you don't want to be lugging that around in a tiny home. So I can understand why people wouldn't want to go down that route. The other way, like electric instantaneous, uses a lot of power. So when you see the, you know, the zip hydro taps, which you might see in, you often see them in, you know, office spaces and things like that. They use a lot of power. They are drawing a lot of power in one go to create that. And that's very difficult if you're off grid. You know, it's very hard to generate that amount of electricity in one go. So yeah, you're kind of in a tricky situation, really. And so yeah, gas instantaneous is probably still a good way to go, but just yeah, be very mindful of where that's being placed and how, try and get it as far away from any windows as possible, basically.
Yeah, no, that's a really good tip, because it's something I didn't even consider. But yeah, I'm kind of like visualizing in my mind. I'm like, how close is it actually?
It out with a tape measure.
Yeah, totally. So Paul, before we, I would love to hear more about, you know, what you guys do, your building design services and the work that you do with the council and the DAs for people. But I've just got one last question for you that I feel like we've touched on it a little bit, but you know, you mentioned that that Venn diagram, that trifecta of the social, the financial, the economics and the environmental. So in terms of a tiny house, can you share with us just a little bit more about, so like, constructing or designing a tiny home that's low cost to build as well as low cost to run, or as, you know, low as possible, just some of maybe the considerations or the factors to look out for that?
Well, I don't want to be flippant, but it's not possible to build anything low cost at the moment.
Yeah, lower. Okay, let's say lower cost.
Well, lower cost, you know, I suppose there's, again, it's where you can really find things that are gonna, you know, the cheapest product that's gonna be zero VOC, zero formaldehyde, recyclable, but it's gonna behave well for you, really, and that's often new products, I guess. Recycled materials are amazing, but not necessarily the cheapest. So if I just swing my camera around, we've got a beam up here, which was reclaimed from the petrol station and the motel that were demolished in Malua Bay when we were building this building. So the builders went down for a swim, came back, said, oh, we found all these beams. And we've got, my bench here is made out of them. You know, 40-year-old Oregon beams, fantastic. We got them for a case of Corona, right? You know, traded them for the builder or the demolisher. We got them up here. The cheapest, most sustainable timber, you'd think. You know, and then the builder spent a week sanding and planing them at $50 an hour, you know?
Yeah.
And then they became the most expensive timber. that we'd put into the building, you know? So, and the timber that he had, he bought the beam already for this and he took it back, you know, and he got his money back on the beam. And the new beam would have been much cheaper than the old beam, you know? So it's without it, you know, it sounds depressing and it sounds a bit, I don't know, bit corporate and a bit sort of straight down the line. But actually, off the shelf products, if you can get something that is a builder understands how to use and it's got good properties and it's, you know, again, Colorbond is really cheap. You know, if you just Colorbond the outside of the building in its entirety, that's going to be cheaper than having one wall of Colorbond, one wall of WeatherTex, and one wall of,
Timber.
bridge timbers that you found reclaimed. Because don't forget, you know, when I reclaimed these old shutters from Sydney, and I was just about to start sanding them, and this kind of an old thing from uni came back into my brain, and it was a bit like Sydney 100 years ago, timber. Lead. Better just check if there's lead in it. You know, went to the Bunnings, got my lead tester. Lead tester went red before I'd even put it on. You know, it was just in the air. It was like, whoa. I was like, oh, you know, then I've got to wet strip everything or sandblast it. And then I've got 2 ton of lead filled sand. You know, it's swings and roundabout. It's very difficult. So, you know, often my clients come to me with all these great dreams of all these recycled materials, and I kind of have to sort of go, do you know what? It's better if we just get stuff off the shelf. It's cheaper and it's often healthier. And
It's a fair point. Because the cost of everything has gone up. There's also lots of moving parts, and as you say, sometimes recycled, even though it can sound like the or reclaim can sound like the more affordable option, depending on the context of if you have to then put all this extra labor in, maybe it's not the best way to go. And you've also used a lot of time in that as well, on top of that. And so are you able to let us
So
know?
I
Oh,
suppose a
sorry.
couple of good, sorry, just a couple of good tips. Those blinds there, they're Bunnings honeycomb blinds. Those honeycomb blinds are absolutely brilliant in terms of thermal efficiency. And, you know, a good tip is build your windows to repetitions of 300s. So 300, 600, 900, 1200, 2.4. That means you can go and buy those from Bunnings. If you have to go and get them bespoke, so we went and got quotes for these for a 1200 wide window from, if we were to go and get them bespoke from, you know, a local blind manufacturer, they were $1,800 per window. In Bunnings, there were 120. So
Big
standard
difference.
window sizes of 1200s is really good because they are super efficient and they're really cheap. And then with your insulation, when you're wrapping the building, unless you're going to be in a very, very cold climate, use a breathable wall wrap. If you're buying a tiny home from a manufacturer, ensure that it's a breathable wall wrap. Because if it's not breathable, you're going to have potentially problems with damp and mold growth. And the other thing is your insulation, get a zero VOC, zero formaldehyde insulation. And I think that's Bradford, I think. If you go through, if you have a, it's very easy to find the best insulation in terms of VOCs and pollutants,
I think often
and
it's
the zero VOC.
earth wall is what I think is often used for
Yeah, earth
tiny
wall, I
homes.
think. And
Good.
that's a really easy thing to do, and that doesn't cost you anything more. You can get a zero VOC, insulation really easily.
Yeah. I think that's what's most commonly used I've seen with tiny house builders is the earth wheel. So that's good to know. And do you want to let us know a bit more about what you guys do, Paul? So if someone is like curious about wanting to come and work with you, what does that process look like? And yeah, how do you work with people?
Yeah, people just come to us. We do most of our work is residential design. It's either new builds or renovations. We have quite a few heritage renovations at the moment, which are really interesting.
Yeah.
Most people would come to us with a view of a sustainable aim. And again, like we said at the beginning, I suppose there is an element of educating people on what sustainability actually is,
yeah.
You know, what they can afford, what they want to achieve. And then it's really working through what people want, working through their budget, and getting sustainable elements in there as we go. So I think the big thing is for people to realize is that a good sustainable design or a design that we do does not cost more than a standard home to build and definitely not to run. So we should be saving 80% of your energy costs through once you're in the house. But a lot of people are under the impression that a sustainable house is going to cost more. It doesn't. That's where an idea of eco bling comes in. You know, people 15, 20 years ago, it was about sticking all the, you know, the solar panels and the heat pumps and all that sort of stuff on. Really, those things have come down in price so much now that they're kind of standard. But really, it's just about good design. So, you know, if you have 20 windows in your building, let's put them on the north face, not the south face. You know, we're not saying put more windows in. We're not saying put better windows in. We're just saying put them in the right place. You know, so that doesn't cost any more. It just costs time to design it, really. And it involves coming to someone who understands that, like us. And so that's probably the biggest thing is a sustainable home doesn't cost more to construct. It can do if you want it to, but it can cost less, you know, particularly design in simple forms. So not overly complex roof forms, not overly complex numbers of materials. That sort of stuff is going to keep the cost of the building down. And also, you know, we were emailing about this, but, you know, trying to get your floor plan to work as efficiently for you as possible, which is, the tiny home is the pinnacle of this. You know, you've got your circulation space, which is the space which you move around your building, is in a tiny home, you're getting it to be your cooking space. You're also getting it to be your library space. You're also getting it to be your space which you go to your bathroom and you go up to your bedroom. You know, you're getting it to work over and over again. Well, with a house design, can we actually pull out you know, some of our circulation space or get our spaces to work over and over? So, you know, a corridor, can we have a day bed in a corridor? Or an office space in the corridor, or books, you know, bookshelves in the corridor, or your laundry in the corridor. You know, that sort of stuff where we're getting a space to work over and over. And often people are really on board with that because oftentimes we're designing sort of modern versions of beach houses, I guess, because of our location. And a lot of people have seen that work really well in holiday homes. So, you know, you'll have the day bed by the window, you know, you'll have lots of bedrooms coming off the central living space, you know, so trying to eliminate that wasted space really. And if we can do that, then you're ultimately saving cost, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's making or creating a more efficient space. I know that I've got multiple things in here that have got like multi-purposes, and you kind of see a lot of sometimes I watch some of those tiny house YouTube channels and you see like all this really creative ways that they're using space, or there's one thing that serves five purposes or something. It's yeah, there's so much you can do in that. And I know that you also work with your clients around, like you talked about, you know, you often do residential work and with tiny homes is not necessarily, or at least tiny homes on wheels. Maybe it's different for a tiny house on a foundation or skids where it's treated more like a regular dwelling. And so, no, not necessarily going through the council for a DA for a tiny home on wheels, but what kind of like work do you do with people that you work with around the DAs for residential buildings?
Yeah, we do. We do regularly submit DAs for people.
Yeah.
We would look at all that stuff early doors. So yeah. There's a lot of constraints. Your bushfire, which we've talked about. There's also, you know, native biodiversity. You might be quite close to a river or a stream. You might have view sharing. We look at a lot of that stuff early on, and a lot of those constraints can kind of give us, well, this is where you can build your house. You know, you can't build it over there, or you shouldn't build it over here. And then, yeah, we will often then lodge the DA and go into bat for people with council for their designs. Yeah, and we do that side of it. That's a constant moving target. Town planning is challenging, and it's particularly challenging around tiny home design, where, you know, tiny home is an entire movement which has kind of sprung up and caught people off guard, I guess. And there's tiny home construction, granny flats, secondary dwellings. They all kind of become interchangeable. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of misunderstanding that people have out there about, I just want a granny flat. Or do you want just a granny flat? Or do you want something, again, something on wheels or this or that? And again, when you look at legislation, they all have their own specific meaning. And then, you know, we might present something to council that has a certain meaning in order to get it approved, you know, and that's quite difficult navigating all that side of things.
Definitely, definitely. And I know
we could do entire podcasts I have a whole list of explanations of things that I could put on a channel, you know, and granny flats versus studios versus detached additions would be one of them.
Yeah.
How a heat pump works would be another one.
Yeah.
You know, the 10 ways to get a most sustainable house would be another one.
Yeah.
Should definitely do that.
Because it is definitely a grey area with the tiny houses on wheels, as you know, with councils. And in Australia at the moment, from my understanding, there's 4 councils that have specific legislation, whether it's local laws or planning policies around tiny house living, or they're doing like pilot programs and sort of testing them for a year or two. I think 2 of them are in Victoria, one of them's in Queensland, one of them's in WA. And I know that where you and I are in Yorubadala, because there's councils that are friendly, there are councils that are more that are not friendly, and then there are some in the middle, and then I think across the board it's just we don't really know what to do with them, because what are they actually like? Because they're not a granny flat, they're not a caravan, they're not a fixed dwelling if they're on a trailer, you know, like all these things. But I'm just curious, as you were talking about all of that, you know, because you do deal with council, what's your feeling on the openness or the uptake? Maybe it's just specifically for Yorubadala, because that's where both you're located and I am as well, on the openness and maybe the progress that might be coming up when it comes to tiny houses on wheels, especially, and acceptance in councils too.
I think that ultimately councils are risk averse. They don't want to approve something. Yes, Prime Minister. The minister says, you know, oh, well, this department is the Department for Employment. Surely we should be looking to employ people. And the advisor, Sir Humphrey, says, "I know you've got to realize that we actually name all our departments the exact opposite of what they're actually called. So the work for, the Department of Employment is actually the Department for the Unemployed.
Unemployment, yes.
The Department for Defense is actually the Department for War." And, so without sounding too cynical, the development team are actually the team that stops development,
Right, yeah, I hear what you're saying.
and that is sort of my experience. And as soon as you un as soon as but it's not that they're trying not to develop things. What they're actually doing, they're actually risk averse. So they're saying, yes, you can do this, but you have to evidence why we should approve it, really. And that's where things get bogged down in the planning processes, because they say, yeah, you can do this, but you have to have a flood study. Yes, you do this, but you have to have a bushfire report. Yes, you can do this, but you have to evidence X, Y, and Z. And again, that's where it breaks down with tiny homes, is because it slips through the legislative cracks. They can't benchmark it against the legislation for, residential legislation or this or that. So they go, we don't want to approve it because we don't know if we can approve it. So really, we as or the tiny home community needs to drive the change. And there's an old phrase, again, goes back to disruptive technology, Kodak and what was the video, Blockbuster. There's an old phrase, the incumbents don't drive change. Unless you get an assessing officer, or more positively, a strategic planning officer who lives in a tiny home, council aren't really going to drive change unless we keep on at them. And even when we keep on at them, it's a slow and painful process, because everywhere you turn, there will be pieces of legislation which stop you doing what you want to do. Not because they don't want you to do it, but because more likely that piece of legislation was put in place to protect someone from a different situation. And now that piece of legislation is now stopping you doing what you want to do. But it's not because they don't want you to do what they want you to do. It was there to protect someone from something else in the past, So you've got to drive change and drive legislation that actually meets what you want to do. And I think that's actually the most fundamental aspect of tiny homes, is actually having it embedded in legislation so more people can access it.
Yes, definitely. And I do for sure see that it is a ground up movement. That's what's happening already in the tiny house movement. And I think it's councils are almost, at least what it looks like from just speaking to different people and from observing from the outside, they're almost scrambling to be like, what do we, how do we deal with all of this? There's so many more people that are moving into tiny homes, and most people, from what I know in Australia, are living under the radar, right? And so they're being forced to actually look at this as a viable way of living. But the problem is, because it takes so long and because of all the things that you just described, meanwhile there's people and small children and families living, in the car or in a camping ground or on the street, or who knows where else, or they're having to stay at a family or friend's place. And it's like, we need to do this, like we need something to be done now. And I think that's why most people are under the radar, because it's like, by the time we wait for councils to catch up, people are suffering right now. People need solutions right now. So it is that change that's coming from the ground up. And I know, just being in the tiny house space, myself, doing this podcast and working in the industry, living in a tiny house, and just the evolution and how quickly the evolution has come since, let's even say 2020, right? 2019, it's actually grown so quickly. And now that costs of living are continuing to rise, and a lot of people are being forced out of rentals, there's even a wider demographic of people that I've observed that are coming to tiny houses. It's like every type of person you can think of, whether it's a single person, a family, a couple, retirees, people coming out of divorces, and everyone in between. So it's an interesting time. But yeah, I feel like we do need to put that pressure on those councils. And I don't know, let's see what happens. But it's good to get your insight. And I really love your analogy or your metaphor of the yes minister, because it's, yeah, it perfectly sums it up from what I've seen as well.
Yeah, but it's not, I guess it's not their fault, you know. It's, They want to be risk averse. So, you know, for example, going back to the work I did 15 years ago in terms of hazards in the home, the British government did a 20-year study on all hospital accident admissions for accidents in the home. And then they designed this system of being able to look at risk. So one example would be falls on stairs. So if you don't have a handrail, it increases your chance of falling down the stairs. Now, if you live in a 19th century house with very steep stairs, then that increases your risk further because the stairs are steeper. So we have staircase legislation. So, you know, you have in a new home, you have to build your in Australia, risers can't be greater than a certain thing and your treads can't be less than a certain thing. And that's because they will be safer than if you do something else. It, you know, similarly, your car treads can't be different sizes. There's whole, the building code of Australia has been built to protect people. If you look at your stairs behind you, they don't meet the building code. You know, so which is fine if you're aware of that, which is fine if you're living in that space carefully and mindfully. But again, if you rolled out 100 of those, put people in those homes, and then people are falling down them, then the buck stops at someone and they say, well, why did you approve that? You know, so that's just one example of where the tiny home has actually pushed the envelope of building design and said, we're going to forgo the risk of steeper stairs in order to reduce our living space, in order to reduce our footprint. And that's a trade-off, you know. And so you're actually again, you're right at the coalface of building design in terms of challenging existing methodologies of construction. You know, again, talking about our position of our gas heater, or, you know, having your cooker at the bottom of your stairs, you know, is potentially increasing risk if someone falls down that stairs and falls into a giant vat of passata. But again, you know, and so, you know, in terms of legality, you know, where does that risk, you know, are we negating that risk? Are you signing that risk off when you buy a tiny home? Or actually, are we writing a new piece of legislation for all this that says if it's a tiny home? But then what you'll find is that you know, Masterton and the larger home builders are saying, well, hang on, if you can have steeper stairs, I want steeper stairs. You know, and actually that piece of legislation was designed to protect people. It wasn't designed to exclude people from living in a tiny home. It was designed to protect people. So, and then it comes back to right back to what I was saying at the beginning with straw bale and, you know, fire regulations, stair regulations, ventilation, damper mold growth, all these things are designed to protect people. And you're trying to push back on them with tiny home construction. And so, again, someone who's just assessing things every day, they're looking at that and going, can't assess this against any of our existing legislation. Put it to the bottom of the pile.
Too hard basket.
You know, and that's not necessarily their job. Actually, it's the tiny home community's job. You need to get a bunch of lawyers. You need to get a bunch of strategic planners. You need to get a bunch of architects and building designers to essentially write the legislation for the government, get a MP on your side, and get it in there, you know? Like that's the side of the movement that I see, you know, more than the design of the buildings themselves. I think we've got that down, you know. I think it's that navigation through the legislation.
Yeah, absolutely. And one, I do know that these are not within the building codes regulation. And I think that's another sort of loophole, isn't it, where tiny homes on wheels don't actually fall under or aren't assessed under that Building Code of Australia regulation. So therefore, there are things being done that may not be as safe, or maybe just are not applied in a regular dwelling based on whatever regulation or legislation is already in place. So yeah, I definitely hear you there. And what I'm aware of, there are some people, and I don't know the specific councils, but just working in the industry for Park My Tiny House, I am aware of some different local council members. I'm not even sure if it's, yeah, I think it's council members rather than politicians, but there might even be people that are in, you know, members of parliament too, that are actually in favor of tiny homes. And there's also town planners in certain councils that I know of too. Again, I don't know the specific council. So there's people in some of those key positions that can maybe influence to some extent. I mean, I know that right at the top, you know, even if you're in a position like that where you have access, often if there's decisions being made right at the top, you know, your hands can also be tied and there's only so much you can do. But I know that the Australian Tiny House Association, that is one thing that they have been working really hard to do, working with local council, local and state government, maybe even national as well, to kind of have this specific tiny house on wheels, whether it's legislation, possibly building codes and even being transported on the road. Is it because people also talk about it being a vehicle because it is on wheels, and then that opens up another set of considerations and things to navigate to. So it'd be interesting to see, but I think it's just this sort of uphill, very slow evolution. But let's see what happens.
You've often, you know, it's slow because you've got to identify all the circumstances. So it's you know, you've got to identify it in a res, like you say, you've got to, you shouldn't go, oh, it goes on the road, right? We've got to look at all those rules. It's going to take time, and I'm sure there are. Yeah, I'm sure, as you say, I'm sure there are people working on it. And that's what needs to happen. Council needs a SEP, a state environmental planning policy for tiny homes, you know, which they've got them for, you know, medium density housing or granny flats, you know, and you just apply a different set of rules. That's what ultimately you need. You just need it codified, really.
Yes, definitely. I'm very curious to see what happens over the coming year or two, even with tiny homes, because I know that also speaking to some tiny house builders on the show, some of them are actually working behind the scenes in discussion with local councils, either in their area or in the surrounding state, around creating housing solutions for people. So I have a feeling there's a lot of stuff that we don't even know that's happening, that is going on, as well as things that we are aware of. And I think it's just once these councils that are actually doing some, like I think it's Esperance in WA, Mount Alexander and Surf Coast in Victoria, and then I think I've heard about Logan City, but I don't know in Queensland, but I don't know that much about it. But that I think once maybe they have some kind of blueprint or they're testing to see how it's all going. I know other councils around the country are looking at exactly what they're doing. And maybe it's just a matter of, you know, navigating that of those first councils, and hopefully other councils will start to jump on board bit by bit. So yeah, let's see. Let's see what happens.
That is just, yeah, that is one of the other challenges is land zoning issues. You know, it doesn't, they don't know how to prove this with, you know, so it, when you look at a residential block, for example, it would, your local environmental plan would say, you can do that. You can have dual occupancy. You can have a residence. You can have a boarding house, whatever it is. It's not codified in that yet. So, you know, that's the other thing, is that, where we've seen these being proposed, the council often come back and go, well, caravan park isn't part of your zoning use, so you can't have a caravan park. And you go, well, it's not a caravan park, it's this. So again, yeah, getting those precedents from other councils, and then being able to see that, I think is absolutely the way forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And Paul, I feel like I could talk to you all day about all of this stuff. And there's so many, I think we've just only scratched the surface. If I want to be respectful of your time, I think we've been talking for a while now, but I just want to check in one last time and just, you know, ask you, is there anything that you feel like we haven't covered today that would be important to share, or just anything you wanted to leave our listeners with, you know, putting a bow on the conversation today?
Look, I think that when we talk about sustainability, I think that we shouldn't give up hope. And I think that actually, ironically, it's actually Margaret Thatcher who gave us the power. She was the one who talked so much about the market economy and where you spend your money. And she didn't realize that we were all going to go and spend it locally and sustainably, you know, and buying a tiny home, or buying an EV, or buying local food, or coming to us and designing a sustainable house. You know, it all matters. It's actually, if we as individuals make our choices, then it's like Buddhism. You know, if we can work on ourselves, on our immediate surrounding, then that's great. And the more we choose to do that, the greater our impact is, really.
Absolutely. I love that you said that, because we've talked about this a fair bit on the podcast, is it can seem like with a population of however many billion people, it's like, what? Who am I as one person? Can I actually make a change? But you're totally right, because it starts with we can't control what everyone else is doing, but it starts with ourselves. And then we work on ourselves, and then maybe we have an influence on our family and our local community. And those are the things that are within reach that actually make all these micro choices that we have something that can add up to, such big domino effects, the more that we zoom out. And so, yeah, I love all those micro choices that you mentioned. And there's so many things we can do.
Well, they're micro choices, but they become, like you say, macro choices. You know, we've probably done 500 DAs now, like even when people don't ask for sustainable design, I sneak them in. We've had an impact, and I made a conscious choice 20 years ago not to go into heritage design full time, but to go into sustainable design. I made that conscious choice, and we are seeing the fruition of that in our practice. One other thing I would like to add actually is it's the 22nd of April, the weekend of the 22nd of April is Sustainable House Open Day. So it's like your national Sustainable House Open Day. Our house in Malua Bay will be open, and Europe Dalashire Council are doing a bus tour of lots of houses here. So, and we'll be probably talking at some events there as well. So if people want to come and see our office, our tidied, cleaned office and our house, they can see some of the things we've been talking about in action. That'll be a good opportunity. And we've opened our house a few times. And I think the interesting thing is, for me, it's not all about making a living, it's about actually making a movement. And, I've seen people have come to our Sustainable House Open Day, not used us, but actually gone off, used a different designer or done something different. And then years later said, our house is finished now and it faces this way and it does that. And that's brilliant. We've had that influence on people. That means that the other designer or the other builder or, all those other people have now been influenced by our Open Day. We're pushing people in the right direction.
Definitely. That's that domino effect, I think, that happens. And I think when people can actually see it and how it's done in person, rather than maybe just like hearing, listening to information somewhere or reading something online, it's like when you can actually see how it's been done and then you understand the why behind the what too, I think that can be really powerful for people. So do you have a, is there a link, and maybe I can just get it off you later, but where people can find out more about that open day, that sustainability thing that's happening down here on the South Coast, as well as what's the best place that they can come and find you online if they want to work with you, and if you want to say your website or any social media pages or anything like that?
Yeah, so our website is pddbuildingdesign.com.au. There will be links to the Sustainable House Open Day event on there.
Okay.
And I think it's through Renew Magazine. So it's either Renew Magazine, Sanctuary Magazine, or Sustainable House Open Day. And also Eurobodella Council will have links on there as well.
Okay, beautiful. I'll get all those links ready anyway, and I'll put them in the episode show notes for anyone that wants to check all of those out. And I just want to say, Paul, thank you so much for your time today. You've been so generous in your sharings, and you know, we know each other through yoga and through chanting, and I didn't really know much about this side of you. So it's really nice to just get to know this side of you too. And I see how much of a wealth of knowledge and experience and passion and inspiration you are in this space. So thank you for your time again. And thank you for doing what you do to help make the world a better place at the end of the day. That's, I think, that the bigger picture of it all.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And hopefully some of it's of use to some people, you know.
I think it absolutely will be. Yeah. Thank you so much again. And if you're listening to us at home, thank you so much for being here. Make sure you go check out what Paul is doing. And again, the links will be at tinyhouseconversations.com. And stay tuned every Thursday for new episodes of Tiny House Conversations. I'll see you next week.
Thanks again for listening. And if you enjoyed the conversation today, you found it valuable, and you want to support the podcast, the best way you can do that is to share the love. That way I can keep bringing you more tiny house conversations to help you on your own tiny journey. So here are three ways that you can support the podcast. Number one, if you have a friend or family member that you feel would benefit from hearing these conversations, feel free to share it with them, email them, text them, send them a telegram, do whatever you need to do to share it with them. Number two, if you hit the subscribe button, you'll know exactly when the next episode is live. And number three, if you head on over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to podcasts and leave a 5-star rating and review. Thank you so much in advance. I appreciate you, and I'll see you in the next episode.